Guaranteed minimum pay, no more unfair deactivations, $5 net minimum fare for drivers, and driver sick pay. Sounds pretty great, right? Well, it's not a new driver-friendly rideshare company like we've seen in the past. Instead, it's actually what current Uber and Lyft drivers in the city of Seattle are receiving when it comes to benefits today. So today we're going to learn how these great benefits and more came about. So if you're ready, let's get moving.
Welcome to the Rideshare Guy podcast, where you will learn about the rideshare and mobility industry straight from Harry Campbell, who's got over 7 years experience covering the industry and has talked to tens of thousands of drivers and gig workers. There's no better place to stay up to date, entertain, and educate. So let's dive in.
All right, today I'm speaking with Karem Levitas and Lane Middaugh. They are both in the City of Seattle's Office of Labor Standards, and I'll let them explain a bit how things are set up in the City of Seattle during the interview, but I really have been wanting to chat with these two for a while now because I think the City of Seattle has been super innovative when it comes to rideshare regulations and really fighting for things that I think all drivers care about. We talked in the intro about the initiatives that the City of Seattle is doing, and I think that's one thing that I really like. There's obviously been the whole employee versus independent contractor debate. And no matter what the result, you know, if you pick one side or the other, you're going to piss one group off, whether you want independent contractors or employees. But there are certain things that every driver cares about, right? Every driver cares about a minimum pay guarantee and earning more. Every driver cares about not being unfairly deactivated, $5 minimum net fares, right? Some of the other policies that the City of Seattle has instituted. So I kind of wanted to bring them on for them to explain sort of how these policies and rules came about, how it's been going, and really hear from them, because I think this is a cool model that can be expanded and, you know, other cities should frankly take note of. I mean, you know, nothing is perfect, but I think that they've done a really good job, and it's really interesting to hear just how much feedback they got from drivers. They talked to 10,000 drivers, and there's only 30,000 drivers in the City of Seattle, so I think that's a pretty good sample size right there. Frankly, it really shows in the policies that they implemented. I think that if you're a driver listening to this right now, you'll really empathize and understand with a lot of the points that they make on the interview, a lot of the concerns that they had. And if you're someone who's not a driver, you can sort of rest assured knowing that these two have definitely done their research. And I think their office and their team has done a great job. Whenever we see good work, good policy, we definitely want to highlight that and bring them on the pod to learn a little bit more. So if you're a driver in Seattle, I'd actually love to hear from you, get some feedback on how these policies are going. Feel free to reach out to me on social media at The Rideshare Guy, or send me an email, harry@therideshareguy. And we also mentioned a company during this podcast called Solo that I've been working closely with, and they actually are based in Seattle and working with Seattle drivers. They just launched an app. They'll be expanding nationally pretty soon, but they actually offer a suite of benefits for drivers, most notably actually an earnings guarantee. So you can actually select the hours and the times and the services that you want to work for, and they will guarantee that you'll earn a certain amount. And if you don't, they'll actually make up the difference. So really removes a lot of that volatility and that sort of feelings of uncertainty, right? You kind of know exactly how much you're going to make at the beginning of every single week. Big fan of their services. We'll mention them. And obviously, since this is a Seattle focused podcast, I wanted to mention them too, because they're a good company on the private side of things, working with a ton of gig workers in Seattle. So as always, if you have any questions, don't hesitate to reach out. Shoot me a note. I'd love to hear from you. I think that you'll really enjoy this interview with Karem and Lane. So if you're ready, let's hit the road. So Lane Middaugh is a policy analyst, strategic advisor in the City of Seattle's Office of Labor Standards, where she helps to implement the city's TNC deactivation rights ordinance covering Uber and Lyft drivers in Seattle. Before coming to work at the city, Lane spent over a decade working as an organizer, negotiator, and researcher for labor unions and worker centers. She holds a master's in public policy from Harvard University, and Karem Levitas serves as a strategic advisor and policy analyst at the Seattle Office of Labor Standards, the OLS. Karem's recent policy focus has been on labor standards development for transportation network companies, so TNCs like Uber and Lyft. He drafted the city's recently passed TNC minimum compensation ordinance and first in the nation deactivation rights ordinance, and directed the year-long policy development and research process. So prior to joining OLS, Karem was an attorney in private practice representing both workers and businesses. And I'm excited to have both of them on the podcast and the channel today. How are you both doing?
We're doing great. Thanks for having us, Harry.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, it was a bit of a mouthful in the bios. You two have been up to a lot and done a lot and have quite the established and esteemed career. It was kind of cool for me to have both of you on because I really want to actually dig into some of these items and put them in terms that drivers and workers out there are seeing and probably experiencing. You know, I think Seattle has been a real leader when it comes to advocating for drivers' rights, you know, maybe on the public side, on the private side. I kind of want to start there. What is there something in the water in Seattle that just sort of makes it an advocate for drivers, workers, you know, on both the public and private sides?
I can kick us off on that one. Seattle has a fairly long, even though the rideshare industry isn't that long, you know, fairly long history of driver engagement, driver activism, drivers who are pushing for reforms, letting the city know that, you know, there's a lot of great things about the rideshare industry, but there's also plenty of room for improvement. So that's the general background. More specifically, outside of rideshare and TNCs, Seattle has a lengthy history of putting workers and workers' rights front and center. So one of the first cities to pass a $15 minimum wage, one of the first cities to pass scheduling protections for retail and food service industries, one of the first cities to extend those types of workplace rights to folks who aren't classified as employees. So that we have a domestic workers ordinance, which guarantees, hey, even if you're not an employee, you're going to get minimum wage in Seattle. You're going to get rest breaks. So we kind of had that going for us. We had that sort of background, both driver engagement and being attuned to what is important for workers. And one of the things we started hearing from driver advocates is that, hey, pay is too low, and we're really concerned about deactivations. We started thinking about, hey, you know, what are kind of policy ways to address that? But we didn't want to sort of put the cart before the horse or get too far ahead of our skis. And so we went out and did a lot of driver contact. We went and talked to a ton of drivers. We did one-on-one interviews. We did focus groups, roundtables. We had a telephone town hall with over 8,000 drivers who called in and spoke to us. Total, over 10,000 driver contacts. And largely echoed what we had heard from some of the advocates that, hey, pay's too low. We can't cover our expenses, which are getting higher, and we're really worried about getting deactivated and not having a way to sort of say, hey, here's what happened. Here's my side of the story. Yeah. Putting all that together, we started working with outside experts to try to develop policy solutions for that, minimum pay guarantees and deactivation rights, which I think Lane is going to talk a little bit more about.
One of the things that's always stood out to me about Seattle is that it's sort of taken a little bit of a different approach than other regions in that, you know, I feel like a lot of the focus is on should drivers be employees to get all of these protections. And I think that the surveys have been pretty clear. And obviously you talked to 10,000 drivers. So I'm assuming you probably saw similar that there are some positives of driving and gig work, that they enjoy the flexibility, that they enjoy, you know, kind of being their own boss and not having someone looking after their schedule is obviously the thing that people like most after the earnings, of course. And it seems like you guys have sort of taken just a high level approach that you kind of want to keep things as is with independent contractors, but add some benefits, right? Add some floors to, you know, minimum pay, for example, but not go all the way. So I'm curious, you know, what was the sort of impetus for that approach? Was it from talking to all those drivers?
The policies don't affect whether drivers are employees or independent contractors. They are silent on that. They don't have an opinion, right? And they just say, hey, you work for a TNC. You need to be guaranteed these rights. You need to make pay at a certain level, and you have rights around deactivation. There's pluses and minuses probably of both approaches, but you know, we I think took this approach as perhaps the quicker way to sort of get some of these baseline drivers. We certainly heard a lot about flexibility from talking to drivers, which is front and center for many. One thing we also heard was that flexibility is important, but it's in fact limited by some of the stuff that was already existing in the industry. So for example, if your pay is so low, you need to work 50, 60 plus hours a week to make ends meet. How flexible is that? If you need to chase surge, which is only going to happen during morning rush, evening rush, or after the bars, then that's not flexibility in maybe the truest sense. So we thought by building in those minimum pay guarantees, in effect, we're actually supporting flexibility because folks can take a break because they know they're going to make enough and they can go to their kids' doctor's appointments, that kind of stuff.
No, I think that's all exactly right. I mean, the real question is, you know, how do we raise standards for all workers, regardless of their classification? And that's the approach that Seattle's taken.
I think what gets lost a lot of times in the employee versus independent contractor debate, right, is that the drivers need things now. And that's kind of what, you know, just to reiterate, like, that's what I liked about Seattle's approach. It's sort of like, hey, there's a lot of other things going on, but what can we do right now to improve workers' lives? Like, if you've been, you know, fighting for drivers to become employees, you really haven't made a lot of actual tangible progress, I guess I would say, because drivers are not employees, right? So in that sense, drivers haven't received anything right now. And so I think that those two core issues, you know, around pay and deactivation. You know, really, since I did my first Uber and Lyft ride as a driver 7 years ago, I mean, those were probably two of the top two or three issues 7 years ago. And it sounds like they're still a top issue today. I mean, about how many drivers are there in Seattle? 50,000 or so?
Pre-pandemic, it was right around 30 to 32 mm-hmm. of currently licensed drivers. How many yeah. are actually active? That's a lot harder to say. That dipped down quite a bit, obviously, during the pandemic. And so trying to, you know, I don't have a super accurate count.
That's a good ballpark, right now, though. Yeah.
Yeah. Probably yeah. shifted between 20 and 30, I'd say.
Okay. If you talk to 10,000 of them, you get a pretty good sense. And I kind of often joke that, you know, I've talked to tens of thousands of workers, you know, day in, day out, right, for 7 years, email, calls, interviews, social media. And it kind of sometimes takes that type of breadth, right? And some of the data that was ended up being released as part of some of the work that you guys did. I remember one of the stats that stood out to me was that, you know, some drivers were actually earning below $10 an hour and other drivers were earning over $40 an hour on average. And those are obviously the two extremes, but you can imagine if you get into two different cars and get those two drivers, they're going to have very different opinions about the services that they're working for, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think we heard from folks, you know, hey, you're doing too much and hey, you're not doing enough. And we want these policies to go further. As policy folks and certainly the electeds who are also enacting these, you know, it's all about trying to find a balance that addresses as many of the problem areas that were identified and maintains, you know, a certain amount of balance. And we worked a lot with the TNCs directly to hear, yeah. you know, what their feedback was on all of these policies. They didn't like everything, you know, mm-hmm. but we got some really valuable feedback as well from that.
Hmm. What was some of their feedback?
You know, we had some discussions around like what kind of information should drivers get on their receipts? How specific mm-hmm. should information be? And they had some really good input about, you know, this is just a technical issue about, hey, you know, don't construct the information around a certain radius of where you have to pick up and drop off, like doing mm-hmm. it with these types of coordinates. So just, you know, everything from really technical stuff or to even they provided feedback around the pay policy is focused on when you have a passenger in the car, right?
Yeah.
And I think it said that in the ordinance, you know, you have to pay at a certain level once the passenger gets in the car. They're like, well, we don't have a way to track when a passenger gets in the car. We're not tracking someone entering. You need to base it on when the driver hits begin trip in the app. Mm-hmm. You know? So just really practical stuff that was really helpful.
Got it. So sort of balancing the policy decisions or I guess framework with, you know, the actual real life experience of how the app works or how drivers are using it, it sounds like.
Exactly.
Is there anything unique about the driver population in Seattle that you've found that's maybe different in other cities?
That's a little harder to answer because I don't feel like I have great visibility into exactly what's happening, say, in yeah. Portland or LA. So that's a little harder to answer. You know, I think there's probably a lot of similarities, heavily immigrant population, a lot of different languages.
Yeah. Well, you know, one of the reasons why I ask is because I think this model has been, you know, which we're obviously going to keep diving into, but I think it's been very successful in Seattle. And, you know, I get a lot of people reaching out to me from other cities, and I imagine it's interesting for them to understand, you know, like what are the dynamics that are happening in Seattle? You know, what does the driver population look like? What is the organizations regulating? Can you briefly explain, like, what does the, I guess you would say, like, tree look like? Like, who's in charge of Uber and Lyft drivers and regulating the companies? You know, I think I mentioned that both of you are in the Office of Labor Standards, right? Is that kind of who is responsible for regulating both Uber and Lyft and drivers in Seattle?
I'll do my best to be accurate because there are a number of agencies. We're the experts on what we're doing, but I want to make sure I get it right. So we regulate driver pay in accordance with the law that was passed as well. And there's also a deactivation ordinance, which mm-hmm. we don't enforce, but we sort of set up and there's an independent enforcement mechanism. Outside of that, there's a King County, which is the county that Seattle is in, regulates like driver licensing and all the process to you know, mm-hmm. set up so you can drive. And then this is really getting complicated. The city of Seattle regulates everything around your vehicle. So it's a different department, but the city of Seattle regulates the inspections and everything you need to do to get your vehicle approved to drive for Uber or Lyft.
Part of what the deactivation ordinance does is guarantees kind of a right to, you know, appeal a deactivation that may be unwarranted the right to hear that case in front of a neutral arbitrator. So that's the enforcement mechanism by which the deactivation rights ordinance is enforced.
Cool. Well, definitely perfect segue, because obviously I think that's two main things that I think we wanted to chat about were the driver deactivation center and then the minimum pay standard. So let's start with the deactivation center. And typically I'm a driver for Uber and Lyft. I'm driving, passenger says something or something happens. I've been doing 25,000 trips for Uber and Lyft. I have a 5-star rating, never had a single complaint. And to be honest, like I actually had an email like this in my inbox this morning, like driver's been deactivated, can't get hold of anyone at Uber or Lyft, can't get anyone on the phone, can't, you know, see anyone in person. And it's like obviously a mistake on the passenger side, but they just can't get anyone to look at it. And now they have no way to earn. And maybe even, you know, maybe it's temporary, maybe it's permanent. You really don't know. So I think that's kind of like just to set the stage. It seems like that's the core issue that it sounds like you guys were trying to resolve. I'm sure you heard a number of variations of that story. Does that sound about right?
Yeah, that's what we heard over and over again. And, you know, also I want to point out that in the research that Karen was referencing earlier, we found that the deactivation is so important to these drivers and this fear of unwarranted deactivation, because they're really investing a lot into this work and they rely on this work. In most employment situations, you have some sort of an issue. If there's a performance problem that's flagged for you, you have an opportunity to resolve it. You know who you can appeal to. And for so many drivers, that's not an option for them. And that's really critical, because part of what we found in this research is that some part-time or casual drivers that drive less than 20 hours a week, they only provide about 19% of trips. Most trips are provided by full-time TNC drivers. More than 80% of those drivers have purchased their vehicle primarily or partly to provide those TNC services. So they've really invested a lot into it. Almost 75% of them are relying on TNC income as their sole source of income. So I found that this is really critical that they have some way to appeal.
Yeah. So it's sort of like financially, right? If you're someone who's now doing, you know, this is your full-time income, or this is 20, 32 hours a week, you know, technically full-time, right? I really rely on this. I think for me, one of the things that's always bothered me is it just also seems kind of unfair. This is more qualitative than anything, but it's like, hey, if I didn't do anything wrong and I'm being deactivated by this company, there's this kind of element, like obviously the more you rely on that, the worse that situation is. But it just seems like it's kind of like a crappy thing to do in my mind. And, you know, I know that that may not be the best argument for it. It seems like there's definitely something there. And from talking to a lot of drivers, I feel like they don't necessarily tell me that, but I think there's like some, you know, unfairness there that just doesn't seem like it's the right thing to do.
Right. And so often, I think what we've heard is that sometimes drivers don't even know why they've been deactivated.
Yeah, that is really frustrating too.
So maybe I can walk you through what the deactivation rights ordinance does and the rights that it extends to drivers.
If I'm a driver in Seattle, hopefully I wouldn't have to take advantage of this, but you know, how might I come across this in the wild, I guess you'd say.
So first of all, the ordinance just prohibits unwarranted deactivation. And that just means that a company can't deactivate you without providing notice of what happened. There's got to be kind of a reasonable rule or policy that is why you've been deactivated. There needs to be some sort of investigation. That policy needs to be applied fairly. That's right. And then second, the law requires that companies kind of provide notice of deactivation. In most cases, they need to provide a 14-day notice of impending deactivation. There's some exceptions for cases of egregious misconduct, you know, where there's you know, safety issues involved or something like that. So that notice needs to tell the driver the effective date of the deactivation, the reasons for deactivation, and needs to give you some information about how to appeal that deactivation. Yeah.
I think that's actually an important part, because as much as I love so many drivers out there, I've gotten some emails from drivers where like they explain the situation to me. And I think to myself, like, wow, you probably should have been deactivated for, you know, if you do something egregious safety-wise or, you know, with passengers, right? Like there's obviously plenty of passengers behaving badly, but you know, there are some bad apples out there. So I actually really like that first part, that it's sort of like, here's the date, here's the reason, right? Because we've seen deactivation emails from Uber where it lists like 12 different reasons and you're like, well, which one was it? Why did I get deactivated, right?
Yeah, it's really important that people have some understanding of what exactly happened. Sometimes we found drivers think it's one thing and it's another thing. It's hard to actually appeal and make your case if you don't know even why you've been deactivated in the first place. So the companies are required to provide that notice, provide some information about what happened, and then drivers have the right to appeal. They have the right to challenge that deactivation before kind of a neutral arbitrator. Mm-hmm. And in order to assist drivers with that, what the city has done has set up a first in the nation kind of driver resolution center. And we've contracted with a third party organization called Drivers Union, which kind of assists drivers with challenging that deactivation. So they'll help drivers. So what happens from a driver perspective is you get this notice, you find out you've been deactivated. Mm-hmm. You find out that there's this organization, Drivers Union, that's there to help you. You give them a call. They walk through the process with you. They go over all the information with you. And then they'll provide representation and support as you go through the actual appeals process. That's not a small task. As Karen mentioned before, yeah. We've got a really diverse driver population in Seattle. Drivers Union has 14 different languages that are spoken by Drivers Union staff. They've gotten a ton of calls just in the first 4 months of operation. I think there's been almost 2,500 intakes for drivers that need support, and over 500 of those with deactivation. And so far, or in those first 4 months, 120 deactivated drivers have regained access to the platform with Drivers Union assistance there.
I think that's pretty cool. I appreciate you sharing the sort of, you know, how, because, you know, I think a lot of times, obviously, a lot of these things sound good on paper, but then, you know, you kind of get into it and start doing it and it's either a lot more work or a lot more involved, or maybe the results weren't as good. I don't know. You know, maybe this is a question for you in a second, but, you know, 120 out of 500 out of 2,500, it seems like, you know, that to me, that seems like a great thing. You know, 2,500 people had issues. They had someone that they could call, you know, a human that they could talk to, 500 of them specifically around deactivations, and 120 of those 500 have actually gotten resolved and back on the platform. And like you said, you know, for those 120, it could literally be the difference between working and not working, or, you know, being able to put food on the table or rent. So I think that in addition to the percentages, like the actual individual impact on those drivers is really cool and really important. So how do you feel that it's going after the first 4 months?
We're excited. I think the numbers speak for themselves. I have to say that this is brand new. This is the first of its kind in the country. We've never done this before. So there's a learning curve. And I think, you know, I'd love to come back and talk to you in another year to do a further assessment of how this is going. The call volume has been higher than we anticipated. I also want to point out that, you know, Drivers Union, in addition to the deactivation sort of direct representational work, they're also doing a ton of kind of outreach and education with drivers in the area to make sure that people know about their rights, but then also kind of help them with all the other issues that come up. Yeah. If that's especially when the pandemic hit, access to unemployment insurance, know your rights around minimum wage protections and things like that as well. But we're really pleased with how it's going so far.
Yeah. No, I imagine that there's some sort of cool secondary opportunities too for Drivers Union to, you know, provide information on, you know, right now taxes, right? Like being maybe even just general advice on, you know, how to be a good driver, right? I mean, that's sort of what my whole site is predicated on, is that if you know what you're doing and you have more experience, you can kind of earn more, you can get better ratings, better tips, you know, access to unemployment. So I think that's cool. I guess one question that comes to my mind is that, you know, it sounds kind of expensive. So who pays for the 14 languages that are spoken and the thousands of calls? This is, all seems like great things to drivers, and I'm sure that they're probably gladly willing to, you know, probably indirectly pay for it, but I'm curious how it's funded.
It is expensive. This is no small task, and it's funded by the per ride tax.
There's a small tax that was on rides at the same time that pay was increased. It was sort of with the acknowledgement that just increasing pay isn't the only solution drivers are asking those for. They're asking for these deactivation protections and other services. So, you know, having a minimum pay guarantee and a funding mechanism to create sort of a little bit of a wraparound kind of package of protections seemed like the best way to sort of address all the issues that we were hearing about.
And is the per ride tax, is it a flat fee? Is it like 50 cents or something like that, if I recall?
That's right.
Okay. I remember at the beginning of 2020, before the pandemic hit, you know, it seemed like Uber and Lyft and other companies, you know, were kind of like really big targets of regulation in terms of labor, in terms of like the congestion that they're causing, and also the fees. Like cities and governments are always, not always looking, but sometimes need to charge fees. One of the things that I never liked about certain policies is I've never been in love with the idea of, you know, just charging Uber and Lyft more, you know, like adding a per trip fee for, you know, just because they're multi-billion dollar companies. And I think what stood out to me with this specifically. I remember when I saw the Seattle fee, is that the 50 cents per trip. First of all, I think it's very reasonable. You know, I don't know if you have data around the average trip, but I feel like it's probably $10 to $15 in Seattle. So it's, you know, a smaller percentage. You know, it's not a huge fee of the average trip. And then what I like, though, is that it actually goes to something. It's like, hey, we're charging this additional fee because there are costs of these programs, right? And I think it's important to balance those trade-offs. This all sounds great if I get paid more and, you know, and I get a driver resolution center and everything. But if there were no rides because it got so expensive, obviously that wouldn't be a good situation either. And so I think the per trip fee, and I just wanted to call this out because I think it's so important, you know, as a driver, right? If I see that, you know, the city or, you know, Uber or someone is charging this additional fee, but I'm not getting anything out of it, it's sort of like not a slap in my face, but it's like, well, you know, this seems like a bad thing, right? If I'm not getting anything, especially something tangible. And I imagine that if you're add-on, you probably could have added a little bit of a higher fee if drivers, you know that it goes towards deactivation, because that is so important.
The fact that it was done in conjunction with both the deactivation protections and minimum pay guarantees is, again, talking about the how do you balance the different needs and find a path that sort of addresses everything. I think that was our, at least our attempt to sort of recognize that there are costs of providing some of these benefits, and also drivers are telling us they're not making enough. So how do we have a package that tries to deal with all those different tensions that are pulling in different ways?
Yeah. Have there been any negative, you know, I guess, feedback or repercussions? I mean, I guess one that would come to mind is passengers saying, hey, you know, these rides are too expensive, anything like that? Any downsides to sort of providing this minimum pay guarantee and driver resolution center?
Not to punt on it, but we should maybe check back in, you know, 6 months to a year. It's early days. And I think, frankly, the pandemic has put so many variables into the mix that it's very hard to say X happened because of Y. Obviously, we know from reporting around the country that fares are up everywhere. I haven't really heard a lot of concern, though, from passengers. I think my sense is folks are aware that the market is changing, and they seem sort of okay with that. I mean, one story we're hearing is that folks who used to have to work 50 to 60 hours a week or maybe more to make ends meet are now telling us, hey, I'm actually working closer to 40 and I can still make my expenses. I've penciled it out and it's now working and I can spend more time with my family or doing other things.
It's so hard to untangle some of the costs that are associated with this on the fares.
Yeah, I mean, I guess you're right. It is like very tricky right now because of the pandemic. And there's sort of, you know, a much, you know, I would guess you would say like more impactful macro labor, you know, situation going on. And supply and demand is kind of out of whack on services like Uber and Lyft. But sounds like you guys are definitely on top of tracking these things and keeping an eye out for it. We've touched on the minimum pay guarantee, and I guess the name sort of implies what it means. But can you tell us how the minimum pay guarantee works in Seattle specifically?
Yeah, as the name implies, drivers are guaranteed a minimum per minute and per mile rate. The current rates are 57 cents per minute and $1.33 per mile on every trip that's for passenger time, every trip in Seattle. There's also a guarantee that if you have a super short trip there where you wouldn't have made $5 based on just the per minute and per mile, you get a minimum of $5. So if you're driving someone across downtown, five or 10 blocks, you're going to get at least $5. And that's actually a good example of key driver feedback. You know, I think during the iterative process, there was a point where that was not part of the policy. And we heard from drivers like, hey, what about really short trips? You know, they're not worth our time. We have to drive to the location and then it ends up being super short. And so that was a way to address those concerns.
I didn't even realize the minimum fare of $5 was in there, but that's definitely a good one to have. And I guess these rates, are they before or they're after Uber's cut from the thing? So like if I'm a driver, I actually get $5 to my bank account?
Yep.
Okay, cool.
That is what the driver must receive, both the per minute, the per mile, and the $5, what the driver has to receive.
The 57 cents per minute is kind of interesting too, because that's, you know, on the higher side of, you know, what we've seen for the waiting rate. And this is, again, you know, one of the complaints. So I'm curious if you've talked to drivers, I'm sure you got some feedback, but, you know, waiting does not pay very well on Uber and Lyft, right? Typically, if you're much less and passengers want to make a stop, or if, you know, they kind of keep you waiting to come outside, right? Like you don't get paid much. You kind of almost need the wheels to be moving in order to make money. So it's kind of cool to see that, you know, it's not outrageously high, but it's a little higher than normal.
This may be getting a little too much in the weeds. The way those numbers are derived is that the per minute is the equivalent of Seattle minimum wage, but increased to cover time when you're driving to the passenger location and time between trips when you're waiting to get
got it. Okay. Yeah, that makes sense because it's 57 cents per minute. So that's about $34.20 per hour. So if you're only busy about half the time, you know, it's kind of 17 and then a little bit of drive time. So you're at about that $15 an hour. It sounds like kind of rough math.
that was pretty good rough math. Yeah.
I used to be an engineer. I bring it out of the closet once in a while. My math skills, I have to be fully caffeinated and, you know, right in the middle of the day. Can't be too early or late.
Yeah. And so, I mean, that was kind of the underlying goals of the policy was we wanted to be a fair wage, a living wage that's at a minimum Seattle minimum wage plus compensation for expenses, and it compensates drivers for all of their time. So passenger time, driving to the passenger location, and the time in between trips. So those were kind of like the big animated features of the policy.
This is the reason why I wanted to have you two on the podcast, because I'm a big fan. If anyone couldn't tell, I'm a big fan of a lot of the ordinances and regulations you guys have passed. So forgive me if I keep saying I really like this, I really like that, but I have not been a fan of other minimum pay guarantees. Like one of the reasons though I did not like Prop 22 in California was because that it only covered that engaged time, right? And I think the analogy that people have been using is, you know, you walk up to McDonald's and you're a cashier and you only get paid when you're talking to a customer, right? As soon as the customer leaves, it's like, start the clock. You're not getting paid anymore, which is, you know, pretty ridiculous in that context. And I think why I think it's important is because it really aligns the incentives between the companies and the drivers, right? Because if you have this situation where they kind of have to cover your downtime, you know, they're probably not going to send you out into the middle of nowhere and make you drive back empty, right? For example, which right now, those are kind of like the tough choices that drivers have to make. So I imagine that was sort of the impetus for, you know, the fully covered time.
That's exactly right. I mean, and I actually like that analogy. I think it's a pretty good one.
I unfortunately didn't come up with myself. I definitely stole it from someone else.
So. Yeah. We had just heard from drivers that we think we're doing work that benefits the companies when we are, even when we're between trips. And I think you see that in the, you know, how they market themselves, particularly in the early days, vis-a-vis as in opposition to taxis, right? Is that you will get a trip within 5 minutes or whatever it was, right? And that's only possible because they have a lot of folks sitting, a lot of drivers out there waiting to get a trip assignment. So if they're kind of doing this work that's benefiting the TNCs and their, you know, their time isn't their own, we thought it was important to be included as part of how you determine compensation.
Yeah. And I mean, I think historically, you know, I mean, this is sort of what my site talks about a lot is like, we kind of call it being a cutthroat driver, right? So for example, if you're driving in downtown Seattle and you get a trip request, you know, way out into an hour east and during rush hour into the middle of the nowhere, and you know, basically that you're not going to get a trip back, it's actually more profitable for you to decline that trip and stay in the city center than it is to take it. But, you know, Uber sort of makes it very difficult to do that, right? You don't see where the passenger is going until you arrive. They get in the car, you start the trip. It's very awkward. You know, that's why you have to be a really cutthroat driver. You kind of have to not care, you know, sorry, I got to pick up my kids, you're out of here type of a situation. And so, you know, in this, you know, with this sort of minimum pay guarantee, it kind of alleviates that situation. Because if Uber does send you out there, they're going to have to cover you to get back, for example, so, you know, in an indirect way. So I think that's pretty cool. How long has this been in place for and how's it going?
It went into effect the first of the year, but we are still kind of in early days of trying to assess what the impacts are. We will be getting some more data directly from the companies, which is sort of just coming on stream that is going to allow us a lot more visibility into that. Yeah. So that's definitely something we're looking forward to have a self-critical eye to say, hey, is it working the way we intended? Does it need adjustments? Are there things we need to think about? And again, with that lens of completely unprecedented what is happening, you know, in general in the economy and specifically in the rideshare industry, before in the run-up to this policy, there's lots of charts of ride growth and all this. And then, you know, that thing is just, you know, completely upended by the pandemic. And so there's a lot of unknowns that we need to assess. But one thing we are hearing again is folks who are working just incredibly long hours now feel like they have a more balanced kind of situation. We've also heard about like consistency, knowing that if you get a ride in Seattle, you're going to be paid at a certain rate. And so that allows folks to sort of plan, hey, if I do these three rides or these, you know, 10 rides, or whatever the number, the metrics are, I'm going to make X and that's what I need to meet what my targets are. And so being able to plan and have a little bit more predictability is the other piece of feedback we're hearing.
And I guess like we talked about earlier, the pandemic has sort of caused in a good way for a lot of workers, right? For those who have been able to or are willing to work, earnings are, you know, sort of up across the board. I pulled up a little data from one of the companies we've been working with pretty closely in Seattle, Solo. I think they've got a couple thousand drivers that have integrated their Uber and Lyft accounts in Seattle. The post I pulled up was from earlier in May, but you know, they've got earnings of, you know, $33 an hour, $35 an hour on average for Uber and Lyft. And, you know, just to kind of highlight, like, that's a lot higher than normal. Right. I imagine that, you know, when it comes to minimum pay guarantee, it's in like this environment where everyone's kind of getting paid more. Maybe the actual guarantee hasn't come into play as many times, but it seems like there's specific situations or places. I guess basically it's kind of made it a little bit difficult, I assume, to assess the impact, right? Because of the pandemic and increased earnings.
I mean, I think what is difficult is sorting through the sort of the different causation things. Rides are up or down. Is it pandemic? Is it this? Is it that? Those are very interesting numbers. I mean, during our assessment pre-policy, average, gross earnings were about $21.53.
Yeah, sounds about right. Before the pandemic, right?
Yeah. And so those are really interesting numbers. You know, certainly a lot of that is going to be the minimum pay guarantee. You know, there's also different driver incentives that are in the mix, which, worry about around the country. So, you know, that a little hard to parse, but that is, I think, in line with roughly what the policy goals and predictions were.
Yeah. Actually, that's funny. I probably should have done a little more research on this beforehand. I literally just Googled it while we were talking, but the post that I pulled up was on Solo's blog. It says Uber committed $250 million. You know, their stimulus, is it making it to drivers' pockets? So that's a good point too. You bring up, right, there's the minimum pay guarantee, there's the actual earnings and surge, and there's, incentive payments. So it can get a bit confusing. I think overall, you know, I think everyone's probably would agree that it's had a positive impact. Drivers are happy. I guess that's a good question for you. I mean, what's the feedback been like from drivers?
Yeah, I mean, some of the stuff I shared already is like, you know, one of like the consistency thing that was specific piece of feedback we heard that there's less
fluctuation,
a less unpredictable work environment, you know, easier to plan and figure out how much you need to work to meet whatever your target is for whatever your personal situation is. I'll share another driver story we heard before the policy. We had a driver tell us that, you know, both her and her husband drove for, I can't remember if it was Uber or Lyft, but drove rideshare, and they had a set number of hours they knew they needed to work in order to make things as well economically. And, you know, it's somewhere in the neighborhood of 80 plus. I can't remember the exact number. They had, I think, two kids and maybe a third on the way. And basically what they shared is like, if the kids are sick or one of us is sick, the other person, you know, her partner makes up the hours, right? Mm-hmm. So instead of working 40 or 50 hours, that driver's share, they work 80 or 90 or 100 to cover the expenses for the family. What I was sharing earlier is that dynamic, it feels like it's shifting where there is more of a safety net. Cool. There is a minimum guarantee pay. And kind of a side issue to what we were mostly talking about, we also, during COVID, the city passed a paid sick leave law that applies to drivers, where drivers actually earn time that they can cash in when they or their family members are sick. That's some of the stuff we've been hearing.
The paid sick leave, I know that's another good one. Somewhat self-explanatory, definitely very important for drivers. But it kind of makes me think, I guess if like you go out and talk to 10,000 drivers and ask them, you know, what are their issues or what you could fix about Uber and Lyft, I'm sure they give you a pretty long list, right? Like I kind of always joke when I get into the back of an Uber and start talking to the driver, it's like, he's about to let me have it, right? In a good way. So how do you kind of decide and prioritize what are these items you should address? It sounds like you did the minimum pay guarantee, the driver resolution center, the paid sick leave. And I know that there may have been a couple other initiatives, but how do you sort of decide what is most important, what's next, and can you do too much? You know, is there like too many policies and, you know, regulations you can enact?
Yeah. I mean, I think absolutely there needs to be a balance, and you want to listen to drivers, listen to the companies, and try to figure out what is the path of what needs to be improved, what needs to be left alone. Basically, it's the actual direct driver contact, the research we did there. We actually had two different driver surveys that went out. One was kind of asking what you were saying. Hey, what do you like about your job? What can be improved? And so we got a bunch of feedback. Pay and deactivation rose to the top. There are other things folks mentioned too, which we can only do so much at a time. Right. We may not have addressed yet. Just trying to find that balance and talking to folks and getting feedback and trying to center drivers.
So I guess that would be my question. Yeah. Was it pay and deactivation? Was that like number one and number two? And you're like, let's knock these out first.
In a word, yes. Those definitely rose to the top.
One of the things that I like about how this has been set up in Seattle is that we have a driver's union that's continuing to talk to drivers constantly and hear directly from drivers through their outreach and education, but also through calls from drivers who are calling in to say, hey, I've got this issue. So we have this mechanism that's already built in to be able to kind of keep an eye on what's rising to the top of driver concerns. And also that they're able to be a little bit flexible in terms of how they can help drivers. So they can help drivers with deactivation and understanding their rights under the minimum compensation ordinance, but they also can meet drivers wherever they're at. And if they, you know, need help navigating certain things or figuring out how to optimize their time, then that's something that drivers union can also help them with, particularly in language, since we know that so many in Seattle, at least, so many drivers are immigrants and refugees and majority people of color. And so having kind of culturally competent, lots of languages spoken, that sort of information is really helping us collect more information. And then again, you know, it's still new. Love to talk to you again in a year when we have even more information about how it's going.
Well, I think that's a good note to end on. And my final question would be, what are some of those other issues and, you know, what's next? What can we look forward to? You know, you guys have set the bar pretty high. So I think in a good way, we're going to be expecting more in the future. So I'm curious, you know, what are some of those other issues that rose third, fourth, fifth, and, you know, what might you be working on next? If you want to tease anything for our next year podcast too.
I don't know that I can answer that very well right now. And so much of it also depends on, you know, our elected officials here in the city too, and the political will around that.
Yeah, I mean, no, I think in terms of what's next, I think our focus for Lane and I, at least, is very much on what is passed already, understanding it, making sure it's working right, thinking about like, what is the new normal post-pandemic or whatever stage we're in the pandemic now. I can't even keep track, but figuring out like what has changed, what remains the same, and how do we continue to hear from drivers and the companies to understand, you know, are we getting things right? Are we missing things? Because I think that's like probably one of my biggest takeaways from this process is I know like a fifth of what the average driver knows. And so just understanding things from folks who are actually doing this work and their perspective and getting that feedback loop is really
very cool. Well, I think what you guys are doing is really cool. I know a lot of drivers are big fans. I really appreciate you coming on the podcast, coming on the channel and sharing everything that you're up to. And I think also I'm hoping that it'll be a cool model for other cities to, you know, kind of take a look at and copy, improve, you know, test some things on their own. So I really appreciate both of you coming on.
Thank you so much, Harry. May I also just let folks know, you know, if there are drivers in Seattle, they can go to driversunionwa.org. Yep. driversunionwa.org for more information. We'd also, if there are other cities who are interested in learning more about this, we'd be happy to talk to folks as well.
We can definitely direct folks your way in the show notes. So, and we'll link to Drivers Union there. So appreciate both you coming on, and we'll definitely make sure we link up to that in the show notes.
Thanks so much, Harry. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Harry.
All right. Big thanks to Corinne and Lane for coming on the podcast and chatting all about what the city of Seattle is doing to help gig workers. And it sounds like it's a lot and sounds like they're going to be pretty focused over the next year or two on seeing how the results go and seeing sort of how these things are playing out in real life. So really appreciate all the work that they're doing and all of the organizations like the Drivers Union in Seattle and the rest of the team in the Office of Labor Standards, because as mentioned a couple times now, I am a big fan of what they're up to. And I think this is a great model for other cities. And I would love to hear from more drivers in Seattle over the next few months and years on how this is going. So if you have any questions, comments, or concerns, don't hesitate to reach out to me. And you can always leave a review if you're enjoying the show in iTunes. And if you're not enjoying the show, please don't leave a review and please don't email me. Just kidding. All right. Thanks for joining me on today's ride. And we'll chat again next time.